Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Wayne Mattson, investigative reporter, formerly with the National Security Agency, who assesses President Bush's Iraq policy, its chances for success, and how the coming U.S. election may affect the conduct of the war. Maher Nasser, representative of the United Nations agency working with Palestinian refugees, who describes the violence and destruction of homes resulting from recent Israeli attacks in Gaza's Rafah refugee camp. And filmmaker and historian Ken Burns, who expressed his opposition to President Bush's war policy in a recent address at Yale University. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Observer newspaper reports that dozens of videotapes of beatings of Afghan detainees by American military guards at the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba have surfaced. The disclosure was made by Tarek Dergul, a British detainee who spent 22 months at Camp Delta before he was released in March. Leading politicians in Washington, D.C. and London have called on the Pentagon to release the videotapes. The most intense beatings were inflicted by the so-called Extreme Reaction Force, or ERF, that often was used against detainees who committed minor disciplinary infractions. Dergul complained that 5-man ERF teams squirted pepper spray in his face, beat, kicked, and punched him. And every time the ERF team went into action, a 6th member would record the violence with a digital video camera. Guantanamo Task Force spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Leon Sumter confirmed the existence of the videotapes and said the military kept them in an archive on the base. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, a critic of the abuses at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, demanded that the Pentagon immediately release the videos taken at Guantanamo Bay. He specifically wants any videos or photos of the ERF unit and any other military or intelligence units operating at Camp Delta to be given to Congress as evidence for the House and Senate investigation into prisoner abuse. The Guardian newspaper reports that the Bush administration is eager to double the number of U.S. troops dedicated to Plan Colombia, the anti-insurgency, anti-drug campaign. From the vantage point of the Bush White House, Colombia's president Alvaro Uribe is the leader in Latin America on the war on terrorism. Yet in the coming months, Uribe's luster could fade as revelations surface over the overt links between the Colombian army and the right-wing paramilitary group, the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, which has been implicated in gross human rights abuses, including massacres of civilians. A former Colombian Army general, Jaime Alberto Uzcategui, who is awaiting trial for participation in an atrocity, has threatened to expose the tight links between the army and paramilitary groups if charges against him are not dropped. The general is implicated in the torture and murder of villagers in the southern Colombian town of Mapiripan in July 1997. Uzcategui is accused of aiding paramilitary units during a 5-day spree of terror that ended in the death of 30 villagers. According to documents obtained by the weekly Bogota magazine Cambio, the Colombian army provided material and planning for the atrocities that were carried out by the paramilitary soldiers. Among other things, the army designed the rules of engagement for the action and maintained a detailed list of 93 paramilitary soldiers who carried out the massacre. Same-sex marriage became official in Massachusetts on May 16th as hundreds of gay couples went to city clerks to request marriage licenses. The rush came 6 months after the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ordered that marriage licenses be handed out to gay couples. In a moment of symbolic importance, the day fell near the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision that ended racial segregation of public schools. Yet many African Americans are opposed to the legal recognition of same-sex marriage. Reverend Richard Richardson of the St. Paul AME Church spoke before Congress in favor of the anti-gay federal marriage amendment to the Constitution. The website of the right-wing Alliance for Marriage boasts of a recent poll showing that blacks and Latinos oppose gay marriage in greater numbers than the American public does. According to The Nation magazine, black progressives are fighting back with the creation of a new group, the National Black Justice Coalition, who has released names of black religious leaders who back marriage equality. They include Coretta Scott King, Reverend James Forbes of Riverside Church, Pastor Peter Gomez of Harvard University, and William Sinkford, president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. The Justice Coalition has won the important backing of Julian Bond, chairman of the NAACP. As Bond quipped, "The people forbidding gays to marry are those who would have made Rosa Parks sit at the back of the bus." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. Almost daily, the Bush administration has been battered by bad news from Iraq. The focus on investigations into the U.S. military's torture of prisoners at Baghdad's Abu Ghraib prison was momentarily overshadowed by the assassination of Izzedine Salim, the president of the Iraqi Governing Council, and the U.S. raid on the offices of longtime American ally Ahmed Chalabi, now suspected of passing sensitive intelligence to the Iranian government. All this while U.S. troops continue to battle Iraqi insurgents and a Shiite militia group. With growing questions about the administration's competency to successfully lead the nation out of an increasingly costly war, President Bush addressed the nation on May 24th to explain his goals in Iraq. At a speech delivered at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, the president summarized his plan to hand over sovereignty to a new, as yet unnamed Iraqi interim government on June 30th, leading to UN-supervised elections in 2005. But as President Bush's approval rating in public opinion polls continues to decline, there is great skepticism that the political and military realities on the ground will cooperate. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wayne Mattson, investigative journalist and former National Security Agency officer who assesses President Bush's Iraq policy, its chances for success, and how the coming U.S. election may affect the conduct of the war.
Well, I think the Bush speech is noteworthy in that it really doesn't change very much. He's saying he's going to stay the course as his poll numbers are plummeting down to the low 40s by some estimates. Approval rating, those who disapprove are at least of the war are now closely approaching or exceeding 60%. The fact that he's creating an Iraqi military chain of command doesn't negate the fact that the Iraqi military chain of command cannot refuse orders from the 138,000 U.S. forces that will remain after the transfer of power on June 30th. He's talking about tearing down Abu Ghraib prison, but the scandal, as far as the United States government is concerned, will continue even after that prison is torn down. There's still a lot of questions about who knew what, when, who ordered what, when, and this goes, of course, to the very top of his administration, to Rumsfeld, possibly all the way up to Cheney.
So nothing earth-shaking in this speech, nothing to sway the country or the world that the U.S. is pursuing a different course. They're following the same course, it seems.
It's basically the same course. They're talking about now a new Security Council resolution proposed by the U.S. And Britain, but what they're asking for is basically the same thing they asked for in the past. They're asking for U.N. nations to contribute troops, even though Spain, the Dominican Republic, Honduras, and possibly Poland and some others either have or will shortly pull their troops out of Iraq. I think what's amazing is the White House circling of the wagons instead of trying to make an outreach not only to the Democrats, to the disaffected members of the military, to the bureaucracies they've alienated, for example, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the State Department, but there wasn't even any attempt to change the course to satisfy people within the Republican Party. Some noteworthy people like Senator Lugar, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Chuck Hagel, and Senator McCain. So to me, I think the Bush administration is actually, Bush himself is in a worse position than Lyndon Johnson was when it became pretty well known that the Vietnam War was a quagmire. Johnson decided not to run for re-election. I don't think that we can put the Bush speech in the same category as anything like what Lyndon Johnson finally did his address when he realized and his closest advisors realized that the Vietnam War was a quagmire and the U.S. had to get out.
With the transition coming up June 30th, the symbolic transition to some Iraqi government, we don't know how that will be constituted yet. But what are your concerns about the period between the transition on June 30th and the election in November? What is the Bush administration likely to do to push forward their campaign to be reelected? And how will that play out, do you think, with the growing violence that's predicted to accompany the transition?
My fear is that they're going to put a news blackout on bad news coming out, that Karl Rove will be calling those types of shots. You know, we know that there has been reluctance to show pictures of the flag draped coffins coming back through Dover. We're probably going to see the cooking of the books on U.S. war dead. We may see this administration claim a lot more people are dying in accidents rather than in combat. I think we're going to see a lot of tricks played by this administration. Now, my hope is that the military won't stand for it, that they'll, even though Rumsfeld banned digital cameras and camera phones, and not only in Iraq, but apparently this affects U.S. military forces worldwide. This is just the indication of what I think is going to happen, that this war is going to be politicized. And we know that happened in Vietnam, and when that was politicized, we had a lot of people that died needlessly, not only U.S. troops, but, you know, Vietnamese. And I think we're going to see the same thing happen between June 30th and the election. And I certainly would hope that the Democrats would, especially Senator Kerry, who knows how wars are politicized from his own experiences in Vietnam, would tend not to be as neutral on this as he has been and start coming out more like Eugene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy did in 1968, and not sound so much like Joe Lieberman, for example, who still supports this senseless war.
Do you think the predictions of intensifying violence following the symbolic transition on June 30th will play out?
Well, obviously, we've done nothing to, you know, better our situation with the photographs coming out of, you know, the prison now. I mean, now there's a poll that 32% of the Iraqi people support this Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia cleric rebel who we wanted to execute just a couple months ago, and now we're saying we want to negotiate with him. If that reflects the actual poll, I mean, 32%, that means the rebellion is growing and the people opposed to the United States occupation are becoming more radicalized.
That was Wayne Mattson, investigative journalist and former National Security Agency officer. Read his articles online at www.counterpunch.org. Wayne Mattson's book, Jaded Tasks, Big Oil, Black Ops, and Brass Plates, will be published this summer. After a week of military operations conducted by the Israeli army in Gaza's Rafah refugee camp, United Nations officials have described it as a quote-unquote humanitarian catastrophe. During the week-long offensive, the Israeli army reported killing more than 50 Palestinians and demolished 56 houses and apartment buildings. The UN states that over the past month, Israeli troops have destroyed 180 buildings in Rafah, resulting in nearly 2,000 people made homeless. The government of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon stated that the raid into the densely populated area was mounted to search for tunnels under the Gaza-Egyptian border that they claim are used by Palestinian militant groups to smuggle weapons. Some of the worst violence in Rafah occurred on May 19th, when an Israeli tank and helicopter fired on unarmed protesters, killing several, including children, and wounding dozens of civilians. That incident provoked condemnation from around the world and led to the passage of a UN Security Council resolution denouncing Israel for the attack and resulting loss of life. The resolution's passage was made possible by a rare White House decision to abstain rather than use their veto power to defeat the measure. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Maher Nasser, representative of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees based in New York City. Nasser describes the poverty and hopelessness that he says have overwhelmed the people of Gaza and the dwindling resources available to assist the growing number of desperate Palestinian refugees.
What has taken place over the last week, it seems to be a continuation of a pattern that residents of that area have seen over the last 3.5 years. The incursions are accompanied by house demolitions, and of course, several people are killed. Some of them are militants armed, some of them are innocent civilians. And the aftermath, our people managed to go to the area in the last couple of days, and the amount of destruction, whether to the physical property or to the social fabric of the people who lived along the border with Egypt, we have, in anticipation of the wide campaign of destruction that was announced in the Israeli media, we had pre-positioned tents and supplies in two of our schools, and about 800 people had taken refuge in them in the last 5 days. The heart-wrenching sight of children trying to rescue a homework sheet or an older elderly person trying to locate the remains of or medicine in a demolished house is beyond description. And I think what lies ahead for us, aside from trying to assist those people now in the immediate requirements of shelter, food, water, and medical assistance, is the trauma counseling and to deal with the trauma that has been caused by this massive operation.
Maher, you were quoted as saying that the present situation in Gaza amounts to a humanitarian catastrophe. And I wondered if you'd describe, beyond what's taking place in Rafah, what the other indicators of this catastrophe are among the population, the Palestinian population living in the Gaza Strip.
What we are witnessing is the compounded effect of 3.5 years, 43 months of closures, unemployment, increased unemployment, and poverty rates that have tripled from pre-October 2000 up to now. In the Gaza Strip, we have now, according to World Bank estimates and those of other agencies, number of people living below the poverty line is well over 70%. And that's people living on less than $2 a day. The coping capacity has been stretched to the limit of the different families. And now what we are witnessing, because of what one can say maybe donor fatigue, is that humanitarian agencies such as UNRWA and others have now received less funding when you look at our requirements. For our first emergency appeal in the early part of 2000, and the last 3 months of 2000 when the Intifada started, we received more funding, a little bit more than what we had asked for, and we started programs of distributing food aid, shelter rehabilitation, cash assistance to affected families, and creating jobs to do some projects in the affected localities. In the current year, we had announced an emergency appeal for $193 million. So far, it has only been 29% funded, and that means that we are facing a situation where we cannot help those who are still homeless. We had built homes to those in the early part of the Intifada who lost their homes with the donations received then, but we are now faced with a situation where we need $35 million or more to help those who have been made homeless in the subsequent part. We have reduced our food aid package to try to make the money that we have received go as far as possible. Malnutrition rates have been arrested, sort of, because of the food aid that we have been pouring in. But if that is not going to be sustainable, then we could see malnutrition rates shoot up. The achievement results in our schools, the trauma is again increasing. And we are talking about basically compounding effect of all these factors. Restrictions on movement. The Gaza Strip is often dissected into two or sometimes trisected into three parts. People are not allowed to go from one area to the next, and that also affects our own operations, our own humanitarian access.
Maher Nasser, I wonder if you respond to the Israeli justification for the incursions into Rafah and other areas of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli army claims that they knew the location of tunnels for weapons smuggling from the Egyptian border to supply insurgents who are attempting to undertake terrorist attacks inside Israel or attack settlements within Gaza itself. Do you see the Israeli justification of self-defense in terms of the incursions into Rafah and Gaza as being in keeping with what actually happened on the ground there?
Well, I mean, the United Nations, of course, recognizes Israel's security concern and its right to defend its citizens. Every country has to defend its citizens. However, that shit needs to be done within the limitations of international law. What the United Nations, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and our Commissioner General have said repeatedly, and the Security Council resolution adopted by the Security Council last week, is that, of course, collective punishment and grave violations of international law are not the answer to security problems. They only create, they increase the frustration and the anger of the population. And if I recall correctly, the Israeli press reported that only actually one tunnel was uncovered in the entire operation. And when you talk about dozens of people having been killed and hundreds injured and many, many families made homeless, to uncover one tunnel, one would have to put the proportionality of the response and the indiscriminate use of firepower and force. The other aspect to bear in mind is that Tell el-Sultan, where the major operation took place, is actually away from the Egyptian border. It's not even near it. I mean, in any similar situations, one would expect that international law and collective punishment would not be used against the civilian population, predominantly civilian population, whatever the pretexts are.
That was Maher Nasser, representative of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Contact the agency by calling area code 212-963-2255 or visit their website at www.unrwa.org. Filmmaker and historian Ken Burns is best known for his documentaries, including his award-winning series on the Civil War, the highest-rated program in the history of American public television. Burns recently spoke at Yale University's College Class Day, an annual affair that takes place the day before commencement exercises. In his address, Burns spoke about the leadership of President Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War and America's current war on terrorism. He expressed disagreement with President Bush's conduct of that war and concern over the threats to civil liberties and democracy posed by our own government. As Burns addressed the graduates and their families, helicopters flew overhead, patrolling the airspace above the campus while President Bush made a private visit to New Haven to celebrate his daughter's graduation from Yale. Burns himself has a daughter in the Yale class of 2004. The following is an excerpt from Ken Burns' speech recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus.
The great jurist, Learned Hand, once said that liberty is never being too sure you're right. Somehow recently, though, we have replaced our usual and healthy doubt with an arrogance and belligerence that resembles more the ancient and now fallen empires of our history books than a modern, compassionate democracy. We have begun to start wars instead of finishing them. We have begun to depend on censorship and intimidation and to infringe on the most basic liberties that have heroically defined and described our trajectory as a nation of free people. We have begun to reduce the complexity of modern life into facile judgments of good and evil, and now find ourselves brought up short when we see that we have too. Sometimes, in moments, become what we despise. It is easy, I am sure, during these times of international upheaval and titanic change everywhere, to like an ostrich retreat inward, to retire to our spiritually as well as physically gated communities, to smugly convince ourselves that we in this country have somehow triumphantly made it through, that our destiny as a people, a society, a nation is now assured, that like some perpetual motion machine, that we will go on forever. Nothing could be more dangerous than this arrogant belief, brought on and amplified as it is by an almost complete lack of historical awareness among us and further reinforced by a modern media cloaked in democratic slogans but dedicated to the most stultifying kind of consumer existence. We find ourselves in the midst of a new, subtler, perhaps more dangerous civil war. The first one proved above all that a minority view could not secede politically or geographically from this union. Now we are posed to fight that war again and perhaps again and again, this time culturally, where the threat is fundamentalism wherever it raises its intolerant head. The casualties this time will be our sense of common heritage, our sense of humor, our sense of balance and cohesion. The ultimate stakes, though, are just as great as those Abraham Lincoln faced: the Union and the very survival of our country. What we are seeing now is a succession of ideas and identification from the mainstream. In the name of the truth, we have created an infinite number of different truths, all pulling in different directions, all oblivious to the old or even a new conception of the whole. So I ask those of you graduating tomorrow, male or female, black or white, brown or yellow, young or old, straight or gay, to become soldiers in a new Union Army, an army dedicated to the preservation of this country's greatest ideals, a vanguard against this new separatism and disunion, a vanguard against those who, in the name of our great democracy, have managed to diminish it. This is a family problem, our problem, and it's not a red state or a blue state problem. It is our problem. So what do we make of all of this? Let me speak directly to the graduating class. Watch out, here comes the advice. As you pursue your goals in life, that is to say your future, pursue your past. Let it be your guide. Insist on having a past, and then you will have a future. Replace cynicism with its old-fashioned antidote, skepticism. Serve your country. Insist that we fight the right wars. Convince your government that the real threat comes from within, as Lincoln said. Governments always forget that. Do not let your government outsource honesty, transparency, or candor. Do not let your government outsource democracy. Steel yourself. Steel yourself. Your generation will have to repair this damage, and it will not be easy.
That was documentary filmmaker Ken Burns speaking at Yale University's College Class Day on May 23rd. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.